I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a somber and serious subject, the sex trafficking of children. On September 19th, the Indiana University McKinney School of Law's program on law and state government will host In Our Backyard, State Governments Respond to Sex Trafficking of Children. My guest today will be Professor Cynthia Baker, leader of the program, student and former police officer Carlos Gonzalez, and student Chelsea Shelburne. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about a serious subject, the sex trafficking of children. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests today are Professor Cynthia Baker, who heads Indiana University McKinney School of Law's program on law and state government, and two students of the program, Carlos Gonzalez and Chelsea Shelburne. Carlos also is a former police officer. And the hook for this is that there's a, I guess it's a conference that's coming up on September 19th, the title of which is In Our Backyard, State Governments Respond to Sex Trafficking of Children. Welcome all of you to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start, let's start first by talking about the genesis of this conference. You know, what is it in the first place, and who all is going to attend, and what are sort of the things that you hope to accomplish? I'll start with you, Cynthia.
Sure. The fellowship aspect of the program on law and state government affords two students the opportunity to choose, explore, and develop a critical legal issue state governments are facing as a part of their legal education. It's unique because the fellowship spans a whole calendar year rather than being constrained by an academic semester. And students really choose the topic. Carlos Gonzalez and Chelsea Shelburne chose this topic for their fellowship year. And probably the most salient part of the fellowship is that the culmination isn't a final exam or a paper and an article, but this conversation we're going to be having at IU McKinney on September 19th.
Carlos and Chelsea, why this subject?
Well, this subject, and I think it's, like you said, is a somber subject. But from my perspective, I started my law school career working my first summer at the juvenile court here in Marion County. And so I saw a lot of juveniles coming through the system from various different ways. But while I was working there, I happened to be part of a meeting with one of the co-chairs of Indiana's Task Force on Human Trafficking. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about sex trafficking of children. And, you know, honestly, my first reaction was, this doesn't happen. This is in the movies. This is in other countries. Mm-hmm. But the more I talked to her about it and the more I learned, I realized it's actually happening all the time. And so when I was selected for this program, I started thinking that could be something really interesting and really important for us to study.
Carlos, was it an area of interest for you as well, or how did you come to this point?
Absolutely, John. You know, my experience as a police officer, I was able to dealt with a lot of somber subjects, obviously, mm-hmm. and
happy news knocks on some other door. It rarely comes to the police. Yeah,
and one of the things we tackled a lot were drug dealers and the violence associated with the drug trade. We saw a link, a connection between drug dealers transitioning into child exploitation. Mm-hmm. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the first hook that got me. And I saw that these are individuals, traffickers, preying on some of the most vulnerable people in our world, our children. Mm-hmm. And that became one of the catalysts behind this.
And I want to talk about the larger subject of sex trafficking, but I want to keep the focus, at least for the moment, kind of on what the conference is doing. And I would invite our listeners, if they'd like to join this serious conversation, they can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or tumble onto us on Twitter at WFYI. So, Cynthia, walk me through what the conference is then. We see how it came about, that really the inspiration of Carlos and Chelsea to some degree and the product of this fellowship. How many people are coming to it? You know, the title is that states respond. How many states are going to be represented, you know, and who all is going to be part of it?
Wonderful. I'd be glad to talk about the conference. The most rewarding aspect, one of the most rewarding aspects of my faculty work is this fellowship. And my experience working with Carlos and Chelsea rings true to that tone. In their effort to explore and develop their own scholarship, they have networked with national experts from coast to coast, quite literally. We have prosecutors, lawyers for nonprofit organizations who've devoted their whole initiative toward combating this insidious crime. We have Holly Austin Smith, who's a survivor survivor of sex trafficking and author of a book entitled Walking Prey. So she's about 20 years removed from her experience, and she's going to be the luncheon speaker talking about the informed survivor approach to this complex area of law, where criminal law and law enforcement and juvenile justice need to come together and work together the way the community wants it to.
So in terms of the folks who will be coming, then you've got the speaker who from her, are there going to be law enforcement officials involved, other academics or?
Absolutely. We have Professor Bridget Carr coming from University of Michigan, and she, like I am, is a clinical law professor, so a law professor who practices law and works within her clinic. Her clinic, though, is devoted entirely to human trafficking, and she'll be visiting from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then each of the fellows, and maybe they would like to talk about this, are going to moderate a panel. And perhaps not surprisingly, Carlos's panel includes some prosecutors, both federal, state, and local.
How did you build your panel, Carlos?
I want to be able to encompass that this type of crime is occurring not just in border states. I think that's a myth that this occurs where people are being trafficked from other countries. But this is actually occurring right here in our own backyard in Indiana. So part of this this panel makeup is to discuss how different states are dealing with human trafficking as it evolves based on regional makeup. So Indiana may differ from California, but I think each state can learn how they're addressing this type of epidemic.
So some of it is to try to figure out a best practices model here or something that's having some efficiency. And you've drawn prosecutors. Do you have police? Do you have some of your former fellow police officers involved in the discussion? Or,
well, let me preface this, but I was a police officer in the state of California.
Okay.
So I was able to bring a prosecutor from the state of California who actually heads the Human Trafficking Child Exploitation Unit in Oakland, California, which is Alameda, which is one of the hotspots with human trafficking. He will be here presenting as a panelist, as well as Mr. Howard Marcus, which is from the United States Attorney's Office in Missouri, and also a Lieutenant Colonel, it's Lieutenant Cohen, Charles Cohen from the Indiana State Police, who is the commander in charge of the human trafficking unit.
Okay. Chelsea, how did you build your panel? So, and what is your panel? I guess I should start there.
My panel is a little bit different than the one Carlos is going to be moderating. We wanted to kind of cover slightly different aspects of this issue. So for my panel, I focused on the juvenile justice system. That was kind of my starting point. And I really wanted to highlight the fact that this issue involves so many different disciplines in terms of there are mental health components, there are legal components, there are kind of cultural components going in there. So my panel is actually consisting of, we have first Abigail Kuzma, who is actually from here in Indiana. She's works the Attorney General's office and she co-chairs the the task force. So she's had something she's really passionate about, and she has had tons of experience working in Indiana and kind of learning from other states as well on how states can kind of come up with a plan to address this issue. And then we also are going to have Christine Reno, who is from Shared Hope. And Shared Hope is a not-for-profit out of Washington, D.C., and their sole purpose is to combat human trafficking. And Christine actually was the person kind of in charge of conducting a nationwide assessment or survey of how each state is kind of doing as far as this issue. What are their laws like? Are they taking care of their victims? Are they prosecuting? And she has, so she has tons of information about what other states are doing, and she's kind of a policy advisor. And then the last person will be Dr. Lisa Elwood from University of Indianapolis. And her specialty is in clinical psychology, but she focuses on the effect of trauma in children. And she's done a lot of work with sexual trauma in particular. So she's really going to be able to bring in that other aspect of how the victim gets into these situations, and then also the really severe effects psychologically that these children will suffer long term, and kind of how we can tailor our services and our response to the fact that the children are going to have pretty severe psychological trauma after this happens.
We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children today on No Limits, a somber subject. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, who all can come to this conference? I mean, is it open to the general public if there are people who are interested in this subject? Cynthia.
You bet. The online registration is open and is available on the IU McKinney webpage.
Feel free to give the URL here. Maybe the students know it. They probably access it more often.
I just
often.
Click it on my computer. Let me see.
It might be on the back there, yeah.
If you go to Program on Law and State Government.
Okay, Program on Law and State Government. If they just Google that, they'll come up. They'll come up with it. And how much is it free for the public to attend, or is there a cost to attending?
We have a small cost for the public to attend, and if lawyers want to get continuing legal education credit and so forth, there's a small additional cost for that. But however, there are scholarships available. Mm-hmm. We're inviting college students to attend at no cost, and other citizens, if finances is a trouble, I think it's maybe $35 to attend for a citizen and for an all-day conference, including lunch and written materials of the work of the students.
And other than the two panels, what are some of the things that people will see there? They'll hear the luncheon speaker, presumably.
Correct. The keynote speakers are the luncheon speaker and also Professor Bridget Carr from University of Michigan.
Okay. And then are there other panels programs besides these two?
Then the absolute highlight of the conference, of course, we'll be hearing the student scholarship of Chelsea and Carlos, who will give an overview of their work in this area throughout the year and then share a contribution, an idea to our legal community about what gap we might be able to fill, both statutorily, legally, organizationally, or as lawyers toward combating this issue.
And I'll just ask, I mean, is this an area that both of you, when you do enter the profession, plan to work in? Chelsea, I see you nodding your head immediately, so I'll start with you.
Yes, I have been interested in juvenile issues since day one of law school, and I'm not totally sure what that is. My mom thinks it's because she was such good parents to us that she raised me to love children, so I can give her credit there. But so I've always been really interested in working with kids, and you know, when I started working, started learning more about some of the legal issues, it was really interesting for me. And so I would like to certainly work on sex trafficking, particularly, and kind of juvenile issues just more broadly.
Carlos, how about you?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that always resonates every time I speak to, or at least when I was a police officer, I spoke to victims. I'd receive calls from the mothers and daughters about their children.
We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. My guests are Professor Cynthia Baker, Carlos Gonzalez, and Chelsea Shelburne. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children today on No Limits in anticipation of a program that's going to be coming up on September 19th. My guests are IU McKinney School of Law professor Cynthia Baker and two of her students, Carlos Gonzalez, who's also a former police officer, and Chelsea Shelburne. Well, we've talked about the conference. We probably ought to talk now about the problem that it is intended to address. How large a problem are we talking about, first in the nation and then, you know, in terms of the state of Indiana? I'll start with you, Cynthia.
You bet. The data, while it's because of the nature of the subject difficult and a bit uneven, shows that there are over 100,000 children a year under 18, U.S. children trafficked every year, that the average age of children entering this industry is between 12 and 14 years of age. And to go to Carlos's earlier point that these are Americans, a report by the California Attorney General indicates that 72% of trafficking victims are Americans.
How about here? Do we have breakdowns for Indiana?
We don't have specific breakdowns unless perhaps Chelsea knows.
Chelsea?
I think some of, like Professor Baker said, it's hard to track some of the data. Since the task force was started in 2006, they have a little bit of a better idea, and we at least know there have been upwards of 120 to 150 at least tips given to law enforcement, which will initiate some sort of investigation. Now, which ones those have led to prosecutions is a little bit more difficult to decipher, but there have been at least a couple filed in state and one filed in federal court. So it's something that's definitely, now that people are talking about it more, I think that people are becoming more aware and seeing the signs of it and then coming forward and talking to someone about it.
Carlos, you've had the experience, obviously, of seeing some of this up close as a police officer. I know from talking to other law enforcement officials, more on the subject of sexual assaults and all of that, they always said, you know, whatever the numbers are, they're too low, because this is one of those things that is really, really underreported. Was that your experience?
It is grossly underreported. In fact, this is we refer to these victims as invisible victims. Mm-hmm. A lot of the children are being trafficked through the internet, which makes it that much more difficult as technology advances. Tactics by these traffickers becomes more fluid and makes it that much more difficult for conventional type of law enforcement investigations to occur. These require extensive resources, which a lot of cities and states just simply don't have. One of the focuses at the conference is to talk about how a collaborative effort can be one of the ways that we can curtail this type of crimes. And it is happening here in Indiana as far as the efforts that are being through resources being pulled together.
Well, I guess that was sort of the spirit of my question. We had, just before the Super Bowl came to town, Indiana Attorney General Greg Zeller on the program. And obviously there was a push to change Indiana's laws in regard to human trafficking at the time, and that was one of the arguments that the Attorney General was making, is that in part because this is so underreported, getting any kind of hard data on it is almost impossible. So in terms of, I mean, you had to have encountered, where were you a police officer, Carl?
In Oakland, California.
In Oakland? Okay. And I'm assuming, since you said that's one of the trafficking hotspots in the country, you had to have encountered this. Was it a hard thing to, you know, to establish once you came upon it?
One thing to consider, at least, police officers become first responders. We are the first people to come in contact with the victims as well as the traffickers. One of the difficult things in investigating these types of crimes is just the mere fact that victims do not associate themselves mm-hmm. as being trafficked. Mm-hmm. There's different techniques that traffickers use, such as a fraud, duress, force, and they're highly intimidated and they fear for their lives. They become uncooperative towards investigations.
So that, in some ways, that I want to be very careful how I phrase this. It sounds like one of the tragedies of this criminal practice is that to some degree it makes the participant just that, a participant in his or her own victimization.
Well,
is that an accurate? I really want to be sensitive to the nuances there.
Let me put it to you this way: minor victims cannot consent.
No, I know.
And the mere fact that they are uncooperative towards law enforcement, it's can be an array of reasons. One of them is their safety. The statistics show that a lot of these victims come from a foster care mm-hmm. system, runaways. Some are just lured from affluent families as well. So this encompasses coast to coast the most difficult cases and drains a lot of resources to investigate.
We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Don, welcome to the program. Well, we will try to get Don back here in a moment. In terms of the scope of this, you know, we've established that Oakland, California is kind of a hot spot. Is Indiana, in terms of, I know the numbers are hard to track, but, for example, we talk about ourselves as the crossroads of America and all of that. Does geography play some role in this as well? Cynthia, I'll start with you, but I'll let everyone have a crack at that.
You bet. Absolutely. The fellows in my research shows that just reading the newspaper of late, there was a hotel sex ring busted in May of this year here in Indianapolis, where one of the victims was 17 years old. We are the crossroads of America. And speaking with former students that were part of the program Law and State Government as we prepared for this, one student is in Tennessee. He said, oh, this is a real issue here because of the highways. Mm-hmm. And Gary, in the northwest region of our state, we have exactly that constellation. In talking to lawyers in Missouri, Kansas City, and St. Louis, just that urbanization and movement of these victims who, unlike drugs, aren't used up once they're a part of this crime. Mm-hmm. They can continually be moved around in this industry that some say is the fastest growing criminal industry in this country right now.
What accounts for that? I mean, Chelsea and Carlos, it sounds like you've done some research on this, and I know I'm walking you into an area that you probably would prefer to save for your presentation at the conference. But if you could at least give us a hint of what's coming, start with perhaps, can you give me an idea of, we've talked about 100,000 or so in this country. And I think that everyone was sort of nodding their heads when we said that that number is probably low, that undoubtedly low. Do you have, Chelsea, do you have a guess as to what a more accurate number might be? And I'm not going to hold you to it. I think we can establish the fact that there's speculation. I mean, I'd always heard, for example, in cases of rape, that there probably are at least another three for every one that is reported. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's very similar to the kind of statistics and research you saw around rape or around domestic violence, for example. And I have seen 100,000. I've seen that number. I've also seen estimations that at least up to 300,000 could potentially be trafficked, or at the very least have been in a high-risk situation that would have led to trafficking. So the numbers there are pretty high, and those numbers are only talking about, at least from what I've seen, the juveniles that are victims of sex trafficking. So just to make sure I'm clear, it's not necessarily all human trafficking, but the juveniles that are at risk there in the 100,000 to 300,000 range. And in my experience, in my research, I mean, I would say there has to be, similar to what you said, at least probably another couple for each one of those victims, because for some of the reasons we've mentioned, like the victims themselves don't typically identify as victims. And so what happens is, even if, you know, a 15-year-old girl comes in and there are all these signs that something is not right, and you know, there's been some sort of abuse, even if she, mm-hmm. you know, tells her lawyer that there's been some sort of abuse, you know, there's a confidentiality component there. And if the victim doesn't want to cooperate with law enforcement, there's not a whole lot you can do. So from that perspective, the numbers are grossly underreported, and I'm sure it's happening far more than we even think.
Although, aren't there child abuse, you know, if you have knowledge of instances of child abuse, you're now obligated to report that in mm-hmm. most situations. I mean, have those laws been effective in that regard? Have they stepped up the reporting, or is there, Chelsea, I'll stay with you on that one.
I think the in terms of reporting child abuse, they have gotten more from the sex trafficking side. They have been getting more tips more frequently, because the task force here has done a really great job of trying to train law enforcement officials or probation officers, you know, child services workers, to kind of look for these signs. Now, when I mentioned before the confidentiality, I was more referring mm-hmm. to just the situation where, you know, let's say the child came in on some sort of unrelated charge into juvenile court, and she's telling her lawyer these things. The lawyer,
attorney-client privilege, right? Yeah, so you're not, yeah.
That's kind of a separate situation, but generally speaking, now that the task force has a hotline that you can call in and give tips, there has been a jump in the tips they're getting, which lead to investigations.
And we had a caller who did not want to go on the air, who had a question. Carlos, you'd mentioned the fact that these children come from all sorts of backgrounds. But is there, I don't want to use the term profile, are there certain children who seem to be more at risk than others?
Yes, there are. And it's not, let me get rid of a myth real quick.
Okay.
This is not a poor problem. This mm-hmm. is not a where it's just a minority issue, low socioeconomic neighborhoods. This is happening everywhere. It happens from affluent neighborhoods to poor neighborhoods. White children, black children, Hispanic children, it doesn't matter. Children are being exploited. One of the things that we talked about is just the mere fact that identifying the victim is the most difficult part.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of the internet, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, has made it that much more difficult. The trafficking that is occurring in Indiana seems to be focusing on internet base,
mm-hmm.
what we call cyber tracks. They're not your conventional walking down the street trying to solicit.
Mm-hmm.
Their advertisement for massages. They're advertising for dates, quote unquote. And that's what makes it difficult.
And it, to alleviate the concerns of just about every parent who is listening right now and thinking, oh, God, because that's one of the fears with the cyber, the reach of cyberspace these days. Presumably on many of these sites, or, you know, if your child is active on social media, there are things you can do to protect that child and set the presumably strictest possible privacy controls. Would that be your recommendation, Carlos?
That's one step.
What are others?
But I think speaking to our children at a very young age, just as we do talking to them about sex, mm-hmm. and sex education, this is unfortunately a topic that now has to be discussed, the most mm-hmm. uncomfortable topic that you can talk to your children about, in addition to sex talk.
We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Or if you would like to call us, as Wayne has done, you can do so at 866-476-3881. Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi. Good program today. I wanted to ask about if there's any push in the city to take care of other kinds of human trafficking that are going on. For instance, you know, people that are brought over here, their passport is held, and while their passport's being held, they're forced to work in nail salons or some of these some of the braiding and eyebrow places. I'm friends with a couple different officers on the vice unit, and they basically said that because of the high profile end of the sex trafficking, that even though the biggest instances of human trafficking in Indianapolis are these other places, that there's no resources for it at all.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Wayne. Well, and I should say that was one of the points that Attorney General Greg Zeller made, is that the idea of human sexual trafficking gets all of the attention, but we need to realize this is a much, much larger problem than that, that there are all sorts of ways that human beings are trafficked. Cynthia.
Well, with the passage of the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act in 2000, which does encompass all of these aspects of human trafficking, states have, the caller asked whether there were other initiatives at this state and elsewhere to have their laws and legal law enforcement fill that gap. And there are critics of some of these amnesty rules in the juvenile justice system, that we are, as a democracy, spending too much time and money here when there are other humans being trafficked. So it's just another of those difficult public policy questions that we, as citizens, have to decide where we want to put our law enforcement and judicial dollar.
Well, and some of it, too, is obviously it's a horrible crime. I think there is something about the assault on innocence itself, on the idea of children, that is ratchets things up in terms of the considerations. And I do not want to minimize a crime against anyone. It's wrong regardless. But I think we'd be less than honest if we didn't say the fact that somebody is taking advantage of children raises the stakes a great deal here. Chelsea, and I guess I would like to ask, you've alluded a couple of times to the kind of damage this does to the kids who get pulled into it. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, excuse me, in terms of children who are pulled into this at a young age, part of it kind of starts beforehand. If you think about, for example, something that a lot of research has been done on, the fact that many of the young girls, at least, that end up in these situations came from foster homes, they were runaways, or they lived in some sort of group home. And eventually they start to go into, you know, the trafficking business, and then their worth is kind of devalued, I guess you would say.
And their sense of self-worth,
right,
is
exactly.
Shattered too. We're going to pick up on that more after the break. We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children here on No Limits. My guests are Professor Cynthia Baker and her students Carlos Gonzalez and Chelsea Shelburne of the IU McKinney School of Law. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the sexual trafficking of children, a somber subject, in anticipation of a conference that will deal with how states are dealing with this problem. My guests are three of the organizers and hosts of that program, Professor Cynthia Baker and her students Carlos Gonzalez and Chelsea Shelburne from the IU McKinney School of Law. And we were talking just before we went to the break, Chelsea, about the damage this does to the children. If I want to give you a chance to finish your thought. And then I think to give you sort of a heads up about where we're going, we're talking about this from the victim's perspective. I'd kind of like to get some sort of profile of the victimizers here. It seems to me, and it, you know, for this practice to exist, there has to be a market for it. And I'd like to know who is providing that market. Chelsea.
So from the psychological standpoint, the children that have become victims of sex trafficking are undoubtedly not only exposed to extreme sexual abuse, because every time that child is forced to have sex with someone, that is a whole new sexual abuse situation that is going to create more trauma. In addition to that, the children are probably subject to a lot of violence, emotional abuse. And as a result of all of that, and as a result of the fact that they get into a place where they don't feel like anyone can help them, mm-hmm. they are psychologically, emotionally, physically being held captive by this person. You know, they really do start to feel like they're invisible and that it doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter to them. And from a psychological standpoint, you know, especially for children that are 12, 13, 14, that's incredibly damaging. Even if they do survive the situation they're in, you know, when they become young adults or later in life, it's a real struggle to find a way to get past all of that trauma they suffered as young children and to kind of become more, you know, productive and healthy in their own lives.
Well, and that sets up, Carlos, who would do that to a child?
You know, I pause because it's there is no specific demographics or any specific race or gender or anything. Predominantly, yes, it is males. But as far as backgrounds, these are businessmen, professionals. They're you know, educators. It varies in as far as background. But the demand is what's making this is the catalyst behind this. It's pushing this because there is a high demand in the exploitation of children.
And in terms of, I know you said there's no pro. You know, it can be businessmen, educators, all sorts of folks, primarily male. Do we know some sort of psychological profile, though, of you know, what compels someone to do something like this, Cynthia?
Well, I do not have a degree in psychology or anything close, but I think it's quite patently obvious that these human beings aren't able to form normal human sexual relations, and this business and industry serves that need. And unfortunately, as we've learned quite conveniently and almost efficiently, I think one thing Chelsea and Carlos and I have learned is to dismiss this pimp prostitute John model that we associate with prostitution and really focus on trafficker, victim, and buyer. And it's that business model that is serving those who profit from trafficking children.
We are talking about the sexual trafficking of children on No Limits today. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Carlos, I'm going to ask you to put your police officer's hat back on for a moment. I know you've left law enforcement to some degree, but I would think the fact that there is both not a consistent profile for either victim or victimizer only makes the problem more difficult to track or to combat.
That's the goal of this symposium that we will be holding. Our efforts is to create awareness. Our efforts is to get the community involved, because as the caller mentioned, that there are nail parlor, places such as massage parlors, et cetera, mm-hmm. that also traffic victims. It is in the state's interest to go and educate and inform the public so that way they can identify things that they're seeing. And your traditional sex trafficking of a victim can look in many different ways and mm-hmm. can have different faces. And law enforcement and the state government itself cannot be at all places at the same time. And it is why the community, it is the community's involvement that will help curtail the demand, that will help put these traffickers behind bars.
And how Chelsea, I'll throw Carlos's question your way. I mean, how will more community involvement help solve this problem?
Yeah, that's a really good point. The community involvement is so important, and the awareness is so important, because some of these signs of trafficking are rather subtle when you might see it once or twice. So, for instance, if a police officer encounters a victim of trafficking just this one time, it might not be apparent. But if there is someone who, you know, is always seeing this guy bringing in three girls every single Saturday to get their nails done, and they look kind of young, and then he brings them out and he pays for all of them, you know, and they see that every week, and then they learn about sex trafficking and they put it together and they think, oh, wait, maybe something's not right here. Maybe I should call someone or do something. So from a community standpoint, just knowing that it's happening is really important, because then you kind of, you know, you can be on the lookout a little bit more.
What and I'm taking a step back from this, but, you know, we've talked about the fact that the awareness has become more heightened in regard to this subject. What took so long? Because it sounds like this has existed for a while, although from what Carlos is saying, the development of new communications technologies, you know, the Internet and all of that, have kicked it to a whole nother kind of level. You know, what accounted for our kind of social or cultural reluctance to discuss this, or, you know, at some level even acknowledge that it was going on? I'll start with Cynthia on that one.
Well, I mean, you talk about the delay. Just in 2010, a Texas Supreme Court reversed a criminal conviction of prostitution against a 13-year-old. And that demonstrates how much the thinking has changed about this, mm-hmm. that for a child to be convicted of prostitution connotes that she willfully exchanged sex for that money for her own profit or her pimp's profit and her trafficker's profit. And that it is just a budding of actual laws that identify elements of a crime that fit nicely over what we used to understand how this system worked, that don't meld well with this burgeoning industry of today. And we're struggling with how to do that in juvenile courts with these children.
And is some of it, I mean, there obviously is the sort of the financial aspect of this, but in terms of the awareness, I mean, is there still pushback? Are there people out there who say this really isn't that big a deal? I mean, I'm thinking of, admittedly, this is more than 20 years ago, but there was an Indiana congressman at the time of the episode in Waco with David Koresh, who famously or infamously, depending upon your definition, referred to the children being exploited there as consenting minors, which, as Carlos would point out, as a police officer, you know, is a contradiction in terms. Minors can't give consent by definition. Is there a resistance to this whole subject because it does involve minors and is an uncomfortable area of our culture? Chelsea or Carlos, either one of you.
I guess I wouldn't say overall there is still a lot of pushback in from lawyers or law enforcement officials. However, I think that just in kind of my like day-to-day relationships, for instance, if I'm, you know, with my family or friends and I bring this up and talk about the work I'm doing, at least one person in the room will say, that happens. Like, that's a real thing. Yeah. I thought that was, you know, in the movies, or I thought that was just this or that. And
doesn't Liam Neeson come in at
exactly,
the end and save
exactly.
the
day? Yeah. I tell you, yeah, we had to overcome that. That movie really made things difficult.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think spreading the word is really helpful, just to your day-to-day people, like your teachers, your doctors, everyone who's out there.
Well, and I want to get to the point, because part of what the two of you are going to do at this symposium is present some solutions or possible ways that we could begin combating this problem. I'll start with Carlos on that. Where do you think we ought to? What do you think we ought to do? Are there changes in law we need, or
one of the things? And I'll answer your question by going back to where the pushback comes from.
Okay.
It's just the lack of resources, or the costs of resources. Having a designated task force to combat commercial sex of children mm-hmm. is expensive, and that becomes difficult. There is a mandate that in particular in Indiana, that says that law enforcement officers will be trained in identifying victims of commercial sex of children. That's a start.
Is it a well-funded mandate, though? I know I'm dragging you into politics here, but, but I'm supposed to ask the questions.
Absolutely. Having a collaborative approach to this topic or to this type of crime will make it worthwhile for the community, because resources are conjoined together to be able to combat this. So as far as it being well-funded, there are federal funding that is available mm-hmm. That I know the state of Indiana does use to be able to create this task force. So that's definitely a start. Mm-hmm. Some of the laws that that you asked for, at least the way I see it, based on the research I've conducted, is recently a website called Redbook was shut down, which is a internet website that was predominantly used for advertising for sex trafficking,
mm-hmm.
In particular with children. And that was shut down by the federal government. On the radar is Backpage, which is another online website that is predominantly used for advertising sexual commercial sex of children.
Is that, and that raises another subject. I mean, is this a problem that the states can deal with by themselves? Because, you know, so much of this, it sounds like the trafficking crosses state lines, which creates a different set of challenges. Cynthia, I'll ask that question of you, and then Chelsea, I'm going to ask for your solutions before we get done. Yeah.
Well, one of the real impetuses for the program on law and state government is having these community conversations to decide what states want to deal with. And Carlos mentioned shutting down of some of these internet sites. Some states have laws against advertising for this particular kind of site. Some states have safe harbor laws. I think about 12 of the 50 states that specifically focus child protection and resources to these victims of trafficking, as opposed to the criminal justice approach. And so depending on where those laws are really leverages whether that state can, quote, deal with it, as your question posed.
Okay. And Chelsea, I'm going to ask you, what solutions are you going to pose?
So on the broad scale, I just want to kind of drive home a point that Carlos made earlier, is one of the best ways I think that we're going to have to deal with this is purely in an educational and cultural aspect. There seems to be some sort of taboo around talking about sex or talking about sex, educating children at a young age. However, a lot of times that just becomes very counterproductive because it's not talked about, and then children can be exploited fairly easily. And you know, in addition to that, we have the issue of demand, and of course, we're talking about the victims and the trauma they suffer, which is incredibly important. Unfortunately, from a trafficker standpoint, this is a business. This is economic. And,
they're not people. They're commodities.
Right. Exactly. They're buying and selling, yeah. And they're making money off of them. And so they're approaching it like a business. And from our perspective, it's really important to approach the solution kind of in the way they're looking at it. So we need to hit demand as well as, you know, the supply side, I guess you would say. As far as my specific solution that I'm going to be talking about, like I said, I focused on the juvenile justice system. And within that, I kind of focused on the not necessarily the court, but the other services that are in place in the system. And I really focused on probation. I think the probation department already has a lot of responsibility. That's for sure. However, I think they would be in a really good position to see the signs of trafficking or the sign of a child that is at high risk of being trafficked, because a probation officer has more ongoing regular contact with the children. So I'm going to be talking about how we can better train the probation department. We can kind of give them the tools they need and help them, you know, kind of be our eyes in that system.
And we've gotten an email from a listener named Elizabeth who says, I'm a local social worker and have found there is a huge lack of services for these girls. Indianapolis could strongly benefit from resources directed toward this population. Is that reflective of what you found too, Chelsea?
100%. I think it's the problem itself, while it isn't new, the awareness of the problem is new. And what that means is we're catching up. We're trying to figure out what kind of services we can give these girls, what we can do. And it's really difficult, especially in the juvenile justice system, when you don't have as many choices when it comes to the services, especially types of services that these victims would need, which would be pretty intensive therapy. A lot of them would need kind of your basic needs. I mean, shelter, food, someone to take care of them. They need very basic things, and then also pretty extensive therapy, and you know, some of them could have additional mental health issues, and it's difficult to, you know, to address all of those on limited resources.
Is that, I mean, is this a case, and I need just, we've got like 30 seconds left here. I mean, is this a situation where we just simply aren't spending enough money dealing with the problem, that we haven't prioritized it highly enough? Carlos.
In addition to funding,
yeah.
I just don't think our general public is aware of how much of an epidemic this is across country.
Okay. Chelsea, I'm going to give you the last word, but you've only got about 10 seconds to give it.
I think that we could more efficiently use some of our funding and tailor our services in a better way.
I would like to thank all three of my guests for talking about a very serious and difficult subject today. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.